Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Scoop. I'm your host, Frank Chaparro, Director of Special Projects at The Block. Very excited to have joining us on the other side of the mic, Brandon Mulvihill, the co-founder of Crossover. We're going to be talking a lot about how this sort of market structure is shifting beneath our feet in this wonky, crazy crypto world. So a topic near and dear to my heart. Brandon, thanks so much for taking the time.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Excited to have this conversation.
Yeah, it's been really great, the show this year. We've had so many new faces joining the program. A lot of folks who maybe have been, you know, building quietly in the background for the past year, let's say. And now that we're sort of seeing this resurgence in the market, are ready to kind of opine, share developments and insights into what they're seeing. You have an interesting perspective given sort of the central role that your firm plays in the market, engaging with several different types of counterparties. Maybe walk us through the model, right? Because it's maybe something that folks might not be familiar with who listen to this show. They know the role of a market maker, of a prime broker, of an exchange, of a retail broker, but Crossover sort of sits in a different camp, doesn't it?
It sure does. I think where it starts, where I would start with our explanation is in promoting the idea of competition, that ultimately, if you want to bring down the cost to buy or sell anything in any market, you do need competition. And crypto, from a trading perspective, historically, has been on offer. The exchanges are effectively retail or institutional brokers, meaning that the clients are captive to them. And starting maybe a year, maybe we go back 2 years ago or further, there's this idea that is starting to penetrate the crypto market, and that's the story of fungibility. And so whether it's a prime broker, and there's some names out there like a Hidden Road Partners, there are clearing models like a CBO Digital. What those models are effectively doing is promoting the idea of fungibility, the idea that an institutional counterparty can buy with one counterparty Bitcoin, they can sell Bitcoin with another counterparty and effectively be net flat with the prime broker or the clearer. And so what we thought would be disruptive in the market and what we've been up to is we have basically brought expertise from equities and FX into the crypto landscape by creating an execution-only trading venue, which is a platform we call CrossX. And what CrossX does is probably best defined by what it doesn't do. We're not counterparty to trades, and we're not involved in the settlement of any transaction. So we're not actually touching the coin. We're not actually touching the fiat. And so for clients to access our platform, they have to have a credit sponsor. And so what it does for us, and our core mission, is to bring down the cost of trading through superior technology, and that's certainly something we can get into. But ultimately, what's most important about our platform is because the customer is not captive, because the institutional user can buy Bitcoin with CrossX, and 10 minutes later when they want to sell Bitcoin, if we're not the right price, they can sell it anywhere else and net settle with that prime broker or clearing counterparty. It really, puts the onus on us. We have to put our money where our mouth is by saying, look, all of these things that I'm going to talk about today, our speed and our performance and our configurable liquidity, they have to do what I'm saying, because we're in the business of competing every second of every day for a trade.
Do you think it's fair to say that this sort of borrows from the market structure that exists in FX, this sort of quote execution model versus what we see or what we typically see on a Coinbase or a Gemini or a Binance, where you have a central limit order book similar to equities?
I do. I think there are some things that I think there are some parallels of what you see in equities and what you see in crypto trading, but I think there's a lot more precise examples between FX and crypto. Crypto is predominantly traded in a currency pair. You're trading Bitcoin against the dollar, right, or against another currency, or against USDC in a stable set of stable coins. Crypto is also interesting because it crosses borders, right, in a way that FX does, in a way that equities do not. right? And so a European counterparty trying to buy U.S. shares normally would do that through some type of synthetic product like an ADR. And I think for in terms of what we're up to with CrossX, I think the analogy is totally perfect. We saw in FX, the original trading venues were central limit order books. And so what that means is it doesn't matter if you have five clients or 500, there's always one market data session and one pool of liquidity. Now, this presents a challenge to the market maker because the market maker doesn't know if the next trade is coming from a retail ticket or if it's coming from a high frequency trading strategy. And those two styles of flows present very different yields to that market maker. And so the central limit order books treat this predominantly in crypto today by having to rebate or come up with some compensation scheme for the market maker. What we saw in FX is the ECN style came about 10 to 15 years late to the party, and it was almost overnight disruptive. One of the primary reasons it's disruptive is because where you have 10 takers of liquidity on the system, you have 10 independent market data sessions and 10 pools of liquidity. So from the maker's standpoint, the maker gets the benefit of optimized matchmaking per user. The maker is not obliged to price each user. And so the maker knows that user 10's behavior is very different than user 15. And so the maker has more tools to better optimize their flow. And the benefit that the taker consumer gets is that the taker consumer should be getting a better price. The way I would qualify this, when I've been doing this this kind of commentary, if we go back, Frank, maybe 6-8 months, I think these points for most people, they conceptually get it, but without data or qualifying data, they don't always land straight on. So the one thing I think today that I'm happy to report is, you know, our volumes, we've been live for roughly 3 quarters. We went live last August. We are up 230% quarter on quarter to start the new year. It looks like we're tracking, we will finish between $1.5 billion to $2 billion of volume on the platform this month here in March. The makeup will be something around 200,000 trades. And the two stats that I would use is one, on CrossX, we generate revenue on 100% of our volume. So in terms of kicking off the ecosystem, we haven't cut corners. There's not, you know, a big chunk of clients getting free trades. We are charging. And this is the one thing I would ask your audience to really digest and think about. In our economic model, we're charging the maker 1 basis point and the taker 1 basis point. And that's on our website. So what's happening is both the maker and both the taker are paying. And the reason they're paying is in our execution model, the ECN, we're actually providing value to both sides.
Well, we definitely want to unpack and digest the sort of direction the market's going from a trading fee perspective. Maybe let's just double click on the dichotomy here between, I guess, what you'd call last look ECN trading and do we say CLOB?
Yeah.
CLOB?
Yes.
CLOB?
Yep.
For someone who maybe is a bit more green to these subjects, how would you break down the difference between the two very simply?
Yeah. So the first area that's really easy to break it down is that in the CLOB, there's no distinguishing between the maker and taker. There isn't a set of makers on one side and then takers on another. Everyone's trading into one pool. And so a market maker who's making a price to an exchange at the same time, maybe seconds later, can take liquidity from the system. Now, when that market maker who's, you know, broadly speaking, pretty sophisticated, when they're taking liquidity from the system, they are now in competition with all the other takers on the system. Now, to broaden things out, just to kind of maybe reveal how unique that style model is, you could look at you could look at the equities market, whereas if you look at, let's say, the retail market, you would have a Charles Schwab or a Robinhood or an Interactive Brokers. Market makers pricing them. And then on the other side, they have retail clients who are all looking to buy or sell shares. What isn't allowed is that the market maker is not allowed to come around this side and buy and sell shares in competition with retail. Those things are technically walled off. You see the same thing in retail foreign exchange and CFD trading, where there's liquidity providers and there's clients. And to be fair, we even see this in kind of online matching engines. If you think about it, Kayak or Expedia.com, you've got airlines on one side, you have clients on the other. It would be a very odd experience if United was coming over and buying and selling their own tickets on the system. And so we could conjure up a bunch of reasons of how this started and how we got here in crypto. But I think whether we spoke about that piece for 5 minutes or 5 hours, what we get to and what I would challenge the industry is that this is not an ideal operating execution model to scale institutional trading.
And why is that?
Because effectively what it is doing is it's providing the highest cost of trading because the market maker has to be defensive in nature, right? And so if you're the user of the system, you're the taker, you're going to experience on average wider spreads than you would by dealing with effectively an ECN. And it's what we saw in FX. So for example, in foreign exchange, if you look at all of the ECNs who, again, these are names like Hotspot, Currenex, Fastmatch, 360T, GTX, and so on and so forth, they're now trading collectively around 300 billion to 500 billion a day in notional volume. And if you compare them with the incumbent winner, EBS, if you want to go to EBS on FX, which is a central limit order book, a CLOB, and you want to buy 1 million of euro, you're going to pay around 1 point. But if you want to buy 1 million euro on any of those ECNs, you're going to pay around 0.1, 0.2. So an 80 to 90% decrease in fees. And there's a couple other extra ingredients here we can get to, but it really starts with the ability to configure liquidity in a scalable and optimized format.
What do you think of sort of the opinion or stance that an institution might prefer CLOB over ECN because the liquidity is more firm? And so during maybe a volatile period, you may send an order at the top of the book and the liquidity provider can choose to accept, which can result in a cross book or confusion in terms of price discovery.
Sure. So I think on the surface, it's absolutely fair to say that there are a number of scenarios we could come up with where hitting firm liquidity is at that moment of time is the preferred method for a client to execute a trade. I would probably highlight that by imagine an asset manager, or you could think of any analogy, but someone who has entered into a position and now they're ready to de-risk. So now they want to unwind the trade. And so now for them, price certainty is really mission critical. And so on the surface, you go, okay, well, in that scenario, it's fairly obvious that a CLOB might be the area to go and execute that trade. There's a couple of caveats to this. One is the ECN, so CrossX for us, is a highly customizable, configurable platform. And so to be clear, we're not promoting, last look versus central limit order. That's not how each user has the ability to tailor in their fixed tags how they want to access liquidity. In fact, user 10 on CrossX through the fixed tag can request that the only liquidity that they get is firm. So now user 10 is in itself a central limit order book. The other thing that can happen, and this is something market makers do when they use CrossX to hedge, is they might come on to CrossX, receive market data. Let's say it's a 10 by 20 market. But rather than buy at 20 and aggress the stream, they can actually flash their interest to buy at 15. And they can do it in a way where we flash it to all the other takers on the system. So now we have two different takers crossing one another. And someone would want to do that to basically decrease things like market leakage and market impact. And so there's quite a few tools, and I would call them almost weapons, of how we optimize the experience the taker. And ultimately, that's what the ECN is really about. It's not just this simplistic, you know, last look versus firm liquidity. It's about having more weaponry to give clients a custom experience. The second caveat that we should cite is that in today's crypto market, we're not just talking about a CLOB. We're talking about a CLOB connected to the brokerage operating model, right? So let's think. So every institutional crypto exchange offering a CLOB is in fact the broker. So when you open with crypto exchange A and you buy Bitcoin, you are forced to sell Bitcoin with that same exchange. You can't buy it on exchange A and sell it on exchange B, right? And so the case that I would make is that these institutional CLOBs that are currently offered into the market, what they're really selling isn't so much around the execution model and the sophistication of the matching engine. They're selling peripheral resources as a broker, things like credibility of institution, things like the robustness of the charting package, things like maybe the customer support levels, kind of all the wrappings, maybe the staking protocols that they have. Whereas in our model, in a fungible model, if a CLOB wants to come into this world where, you know, I'll use Hidden Road as an example. Let's say a CLOB wants to come into Hidden Road. So now a client opens with Hidden Road, and they get the choice to trade on the CLOB or us. We would love this, right? We are promoting competition because the business model I'm in is I'm not in the business of owning 100% of a customer's wallet. I'm in the business of connecting with an institutional user for life and doing our very best job to win as much market share as we can. Because to your point, when you started, that user at this moment in time might see CrossX as the right place to buy Bitcoin for a variety of reasons. And 10 minutes later,
or maybe not the best place to sell.
That's right. And that's why we're really, really trying to encourage the entire ecosystem to promote the idea of fungibility. And we think it's really
important. So the evolution of all of this, the direction in which we're heading is a mix of everything, some version of CLOP, some version of AMM maybe, and some version of RFQ. How do exchanges, some of the more retail brokers with which listeners might be familiar, Coinbase or Binance, how do they maybe move into that direction? How do they adapt? And when will fees start to compress?
So let's start backwards with fee compression, because I think, you know, Sure. Ultimately, you know, the question for maybe some of the audience they might be asking is why is this important, what I'm talking about here today? And I think the way we think about it,
they're always thinking that whenever I speak, Yeah. Why is this important?
And so the market today, if you look at top to bottom in spot, has been trading around 500 billion to 3.5 trillion. Per month of flows. And so in my opinion, and in a very inefficient market, And there's two areas of inefficiency. Historically, everyone's been trading bilaterally. So if you're a market maker and you're trading with 100 counterparties, you're literally facing for settlement 100 counterparties and moving. Mm-hmm. There's very operationally inefficient. And fungibility, ultimately what it does, whether it's Hidden Road or SIBO or Clear Token, what they're doing, the number one service they're providing, is driving down the cost of capital, because they're allowing that market maker to trade with those 100 counterparties, but net settle with one.
How does sort of something like a Coinbase Prime fit into that, right? Because some people might think there are these brokers that theoretically, I think, right, if I make a trade on Coinbase, they might, through Prime, they might route that to a Jane Street or maybe even a different exchange. I don't know the names that they have onboarded as part of that service, but maybe juxtapose that Prime broker model with sort of what you're describing here. How is it different? Because you are just facing off with Coinbase, but then the orders might get sent somewhere else.
So what happens is in the Prime brokerage model, and I'll stay on the hidden road version of Prime brokerage, what's happening is the counterparties are directly, from a technical standpoint, are connected together, and then post-trade the information is going to the Prime broker.
I see.
And so two things are at play here, and then I'll speak about Coinbase Prime. So the first thing at play here is that the Prime broker is driving down the cost of capital. The second thing at play is all of the destinations like CrossX are working in competition to drive down the cost of trading. And the idea is these two things at play should grow the total trading volume in the space by orders of magnitude. Now in Coinbase Prime, and there's others, and this also happened in the foreign exchange market, there are people that launched an institutional brokerage platform and they call it Prime. And what it does is the maker and taker don't connect directly together. They connect to a technology stack that Coinbase has. Okay. And so right there off the bat, there's increased latency. There's increased fees because now you have an intermediary who can mark up the trades or it can charge more commission. And so it's not a Prime brokerage solution in the general definition of PB, of what you're seeing in the FX market or in the clearing case of equities, or what I'm talking about with SIBO clearing or Hidden Road. And so it's not giving you the economies of scale to drive down the cost of capital and the cost of trading.
So this is one component of sort of one component of what's driving inefficiencies in this market. I'm sure a lot of people saw the sort of flash crash that I think happened on Binance, although I'm not 100% sure it was BitMEX, where you had some orders being filled at $8,000 per Bitcoin. Is that tied to some of the topics that we're talking about? Obviously this is derivatives or perpetual swaps, but you know, we've seen these flash crashes time and time again in this space. Is that tied to some of these market structures, idiosyncrasies that we've been talking about, or something else?
Well, I think in part yes, in part no. I think where I would answer yes is, once again, in the brokerage model, you have the client captive. And so now you're in a position, and if the platform goes down, you're totally reliant on that exchange that you're working with. And so if you have a flash crash to 8,000, you've got a major problem. Versus in a truly fungible world, you know, a client's buying on CrossX and something happens with CrossX, you know, hopefully not, but something happens, that client has all this external liquidity to exit their risks in a very safe and clean manner. So just the way operationally the trade flow is working, generally institutions, this is why they prefer the PB model, because they have competition for liquidity. And if any one player goes down, it does not really matter to their ability to exit risk, versus a broker. You're solely relying on that broker. And that's why regulators across the globe, one of the things you see them talking about, obviously they're talking about things like client money rules and capital adequacy and marketing disclosures. But one of the things I keep reading is they're very interested in the platform uptime, because they're holding the client captive. If the platform goes down, the client can't get out of that trade, right? You could. So that's one part of it. I think the second part of it, though, is the business. What makes crypto unique is that crypto was built from retail, and now institutions are trying to kind of redefine the market. And the retail platform was fit for purpose for retail users. So, for example, having REST APIs and WebSockets sitting in the Amazon cloud. These are really smart decisions to make if you're the CEO of a retail exchange, right? Because you don't have to overpurchase. You can get whatever space you need in Amazon. And as you scale consumers, you scale your space. But it's not robust enough for real institutional trading, right? And to give you an indication, right now on CrossX, we're matching trades in 6 microseconds. And because we have no quote restrictions on the makers, we're processing just under 2 billion quotes a day. So the platform is built to scale throughput of data so that we can handle the largest institutional traders in the world without ever having to worry to go down. So I think where the institutional market is evolving, the way I see it is that institutions, for lack of choice, have had to basically use some crypto exchanges to maybe hedge some of their flow. I think moving forward, they're going to move away from hedging or trading actively on retail exchanges and moving to a more scalable model with trading venues that sit in data centers that where the gateway is FIX or binary, things they're more accustomed to in TradFi markets.
It raises the interesting question and we spoke with Mike Belshi about this. Is this market robust enough to handle these flows? Like, do you get the sense that given the sort of dynamics we've seen post ETF that, maybe there are certain cracks appearing? I mean, what we talked about with Mike was to what extent should we be worried about breakage, right? Is this market robust enough to continuously handle those types of flows in the short to medium term, if that makes sense? It feels a bit fragile, anecdotally.
I think you're right. I think it's fair to feel that way. And I think it's a feeling we should all champion feeling. I don't think any of us should be coming in day to day feeling cozy. In truth, there should be multiple prime brokers, not just Hidden Road. There should be multiple clears who are farther along than what we're seeing today. That would help kind of set, to me, clearing and prime brokerage, when you think about it, is really the foundation of any institutional ecosystem, the ability to provide credit and the ability to optimize cost of capital. And so we need to be farther along than where we are today. And not to talk kind of against our own book, but there should be more cross-sections. There should be more platforms that feel like us. Our feeling is that there will be. Our feeling is that there will be folks who have not gotten involved, who will come into the market. I certainly would like to see that happen with a little bit more pace. I think the positive thing that we've seen this year on not just the back of the ETF, but really the back of the name BlackRock, is it's given a lot of energy and momentum for folks to go back into the boardroom with a high degree of credibility to say, hey, let's reopen this digital asset folder that we closed a couple of years ago. And we're seeing that everywhere. We see TradFi retail brokers are putting together plans to add spot crypto on their multi-asset platforms. We're seeing quant hedge funds who either have not come into spot crypto or who want to come into spot crypto now are getting very serious about having conversations. And I would even say, not to get everyone all kind of out of their seat and excited, it's too early, but the tier one banks, we've had conversations with tier one banks who admittedly are years off. So let's not get ahead of ourselves. This is not happening this year or next year. But they have reopened the folder to start having the conversations of if we're going to be there in 3 years, 4 or 5 years, what should we be doing now so that we're not so far behind when we put our hat in the ring? So that's kind of what we've been seeing since the ETF news.
Can we take a moment to talk about the state of credit and how that maybe plays into the state of the market? Obviously, if you think about the institutional leverage that exists right now, it's it's dwarfed by 2021. And that probably translates into inefficiencies, makes, you know, the cost of trading more capital inefficient.
So I think going back to, I'll reiterate one statement and then maybe expand on an area we didn't touch on yet. So I always think about it through the market maker's eyes because they're such an important part of the ecosystem. And so if you go back 5 years, just to really exaggerate the point, you had a couple of TradFi household name market makers that were pricing hundreds of exchanges and doing it all bilaterally. And so they're buying here, they're selling here, they're market flat, but they've got their owed finances here. They have to settle, operationally very efficient. And so at a very high level, the first thing that's already happened in Hidden Road has really been the permanent driver of this is the ability in an OTC fashion for that market maker to trade with those few hundred counterparties, but net settle all the activity. Now, there's a second wrinkle in this. In crypto, and I won't mention some of the company names here, but there's some companies out there that are doing some pretty clever stuff, I think, at a high level around this concept of, you know, part of the use case with crypto is that we should be able to settle in real time, right? That we have the information to protect the ecosystem really through a real-time settlement. The problem is with some of these companies is in order for that to work, you need the entire ecosystem or at least the market makers all embedded into that one ecosystem. Because if a market maker, imagine like a circle of a product and a market maker accesses this circle with real-time settlement, the market maker is still hedging, buying, and selling all over the place that doesn't follow those same rules. And so what actually ends up happening from the maker's perspective is that real-time settlement in the short run is the most inefficient way to settle. Because if you give any big market maker enough time throughout the day, they trade flat. They're not holding positions. The shorter you close the window on them, the more you're creating an inefficiency. So the T plus one settlement, and there's a handful of folks out there that do that, today, in my mind, is the most optimal settlement because it allows the market maker the relevant purchasing power to make a market consistently through the day. Now, for some of the folks who are going after real-time settlement, what happens is almost think of them like concentric rings. And what happens is the bigger those people grow the ecosystem, the more their model becomes more efficient. And if they can ever get the ecosystem so big, it'll almost look like an eclipse. And you'll go from overnight where I'll eat my words. And the idea of T plus one no longer becomes optimal. Now real-time settlement truly is optimal, but there's a long way to go for that to be practically true.
It seems like there's a long way to go for a lot of these different components to come to fruition, these puzzle pieces to fit together, to use another analogy, whether that's, you know, the big brokers kind of coming in and actually listing multiple assets, right? I mean, I can't imagine you'll see a Schwab or Fidelity have more than Bitcoin and ETH for quite some time. It's going to take a while for the banks to get in. It's going to take a while for the market structure to evolve. What do you anticipate? It's going to take a while for fees to compress too. I mean, we've been thinking about fees compressing for years. That's what most of the analysts covering Coinbase had been worried about since they went public, and you really haven't seen much fee compression. What do you expect in the shorter term, something that maybe folks aren't paying attention to unfold in the near term?
Yeah, I think in the near term, we're kind of focused on two things. I think one, the story of retail trading, predominantly internationally outside of the U.S., we think is a hot and emerging story. And the story is really as simple as the market has been unregulated and the crypto exchanges have been selling into a mass market retail environment. And I managed retail years ago in foreign exchange. I know it. I know the space really well. And when you're selling in mass to retail consumers, depending on what region you're in, the users have varying degrees of interest of what, why they make a decision to go with this crypto exchange or this crypto exchange. And again, it comes back to some of the things I said.
We talked about this. We talked about, you have an anecdote. I can't remember. I want to get this right, but I want you to share it with the audience because it's funny. There was one exchange, an FX broker maybe, that was marketing in Paris. And then when they tried to market the same slogan or catchphrase in German, it was too long and hung off the advert.
Yeah. I'll get there. I promise.
Okay, good. No,
you're speaking to basically the cost of marketing in continental Europe, right? And we had, when I was at my previous shop, we had a slogan, and then we had to, you know, it was our catchphrase to try to attract eyeballs and to get people to come over and open an account. And then when you translate it into German, you translate it into French, it reads different. And in French, it was so long, it couldn't fit on the banner. So we had to rethink what our slogan was there. And so when you're selling in mass in an unregulated market, life is pretty easy because some clients are interested in the safety of the exchange. So they really want to know the credibility kind of story. They're attracted to the brand. Again, some are attracted to the platform, onboarding experience, the charting package, right, and stuff like this. But what happens is if we use retail FX in Europe as an example, pre-regulation, the cost to acquire a consumer was in and around $400 in Western Europe, okay? Once regulations were done, and when I say regulations were done, what did they do? What regulations did is they forced all of the retail brokers to address client money rules, to address capital adequacy, so this is how much money you've got in reserve, to address serious marketing disclosures, to totally overhaul the onboarding experience with the user from a KYC and AML control, and as a follow-up, to periodically, whether it's 3 or 6 months, do follow-ups on each retail consumer, right? So I remember the compliance team went from like 3 people to almost 20 just for Europe alone. And long story short, when it was all said and done, the cost to acquire a retail consumer skyrocketed to $2,000 an account. So it changes overnight how you think about who you're trying to attract. And the normal move that brokers make is they start going after day traders because those guys trade a lot and they're churning fees. And so your profit margin becomes much higher versus a client like me who bought Bitcoin on Coinbase years ago and hasn't done anything else since. The challenging thing I think for crypto exchanges in that environment where they need to pivot strongly to go get day traders is that day traders only care about cost. They care about spread and they care about commissions. Just eyeballing it, roughly half of the retail crypto exchanges I've looked at don't even show the spread on the platform. There's no buy and sell price. There's just a buy. So they don't compute. They don't show you what the spread is. So that's going to have to change. The second thing, as we touched on earlier, a central limit order book where makers and takers are all in one pool is going to be for sure the highest cost business model to basically deliver to the day trader. It's not going to be welcomed. So at a minimum, the retail brokers are going to have to isolate market makers on one side and clients on another. And I would say for the more sophisticated, they should really be putting in a smart order router or something like ECN technology to really optimize and drive down the cost of spreads. I'll give you one anecdotal data point. When I moved to London in 2010 and the European retail team was reporting into me, the spreads that were being advertised on euro dollar were around 1 point, and everyone was kind of, I'm 0.9, I'm 0.8, I'm 1 point, I'm 1.1. That's kind of where everyone was, and all the brokers were running different campaigns. today, if you go look at the advertising, it's choice. It's 0 to 0.1. And if you're offering more than 0.1, you're not getting a day trader. Right. And in order to do that, you better have the right tech and the right execution environment to pull that off. Cause that's tricky, tricky, tricky. And I don't think most crypto exchanges are prepared for this.
Well, they better get prepared.
I do think we'll see as a result of this, I do think we'll see again, notably in the Western theater in areas like Europe, in areas of like Australia, maybe the Near East and Turkey. I do think we'll see as a result of the regs coming out, a smallish to medium sized sweep of M&A activity. That's something that I would expect to see as well. Cause I think a lot of people are going to struggle with the changing economics of the user.
Tide of M&A. Good for bankers. Where can listeners learn more about what you guys are working on?
Yeah, so I would direct everyone to crossovermarkets.com, our URL. We're also on LinkedIn. We use LinkedIn religiously, the Crossover Markets page, or you can privately message myself, Brandon Mulvihill, my partner, Anthony Mazarese. We're pretty good about getting back to people and setting up a call to, you know, have an introductory chat. So. And on the website, we've got a number of materials. We have our publicly stated rule book. We publicly disclose our fees, and we showcase all of the third party tech providers that we integrate to. So definitely a good resource to go to crossovermarkets.com.
Great. Thank you so much for joining the program.
It's been my pleasure. Hope to be back. This was a good chat. There's a lot happening in the market.
Absolutely.
We'll have more to talk about in the future.
And The Scoop will be back for you again with another great guest. Have an awesome day.